Welcome to Hochoka Podcast.
Hello, Mataki Epi, and welcome to Hochoka, here at the center of St. Joseph's Indian School's campus. I'm Scott Wooster, today's Hochoka host. We're glad you've joined our circle to hear Joseph Marshall III, historian, writer, teacher, craftsman, administrator, actor, and public speaker. He joins us to continue our talk about leadership in pre-reservation Lakota society, how this can reframe our understanding of leadership in today's world, and what parents and communities might do to revive the concept of leadership the Lakota lived. Again, thank you for being here, Joseph.
Glad to be here.
Always a pleasure. Last time we talked, you gave us four simple but really powerful concepts of how to make a leader. And they're all pieces of solid leadership character, I would say. And we discussed the first one, which is getting to know yourself.
Right.
And then the second part of that is getting to know those you're close to or getting to know your friends.
Right.
Tell us more about that, please.
Well, just as it's important to know yourself, especially if one is a leader and is trying to accomplish something on behalf of an entire village, an entire group, entire society, one does not do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one's a superman or a super person. And it takes a village to solve a problem. It takes a group of people to solve a problem. So in order to bring all of that to bear, one also has to know about the people that are following you. Know what their strengths and weaknesses are, know what their capabilities are, know what their tendencies are. The more you know of those, the better you're able to utilize them in the best way possible to solve a problem, whether it's facing an enemy on a battlefield or solving some social situation. You don't send someone out to do something they don't know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
You don't send someone out to solve a problem that's inexperienced. So you want to solve the problem by putting the best person in a position to help you solve the problem. And you choose that person because of who they are and what they are, what they know, what they're capable of. So in one sense, it's more important to know about them than it is about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you can, it's like moving, you know, pieces on a chessboard. What each piece is capable of doing and the power that each piece has, it's the same way in life. It's the same way when you're choosing someone to help you to solve any kind of issue. So you select those people you know are going to be able to stand up to the issue, to be able to answer the call. Now, we've been talking about Crazy Horse, and Crazy Horse was a very shy, very quiet person. So naturally, he gravitated to people who were like him,
mm-hmm.
who were humble, who were selfless. And throughout his life, he never had a lot of friends. Throughout his life, he had maybe two or three really close friends that he could depend on no matter the situation. Not only because they were his friends, but because he knew the kind of people they were. He Dog was one of them. Lone Elk was another. And he knew that he could, no matter what was going on, if he asked them to do something, they would do it. Or if they didn't know how to do it or they couldn't do it, they would say, I can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm not the person for the job. So those are the kind of people you want when you're trying to solve a problem, whether it's a big problem or a small problem. Whoever has the skill and the ability and the desire and the character to help, that's who you want on your side.
Right. And as a leader, you would want to know your whole camp. I mean, I would think the
exactly.
people that are really close to you, but you'd want to know everybody.
You want to know the capabilities of everybody in your circle, in
yeah.
the village.
Yeah.
So that when time came, you could ask them to do whatever it was that yeah. needs to be done at that moment.
As important as knowing your friends or those you surround yourself with, your allies, it's important to know your enemies too.
Absolutely.
And I like that you mean that in the sense of people who are your enemies, but also different.
There are issues and there are problems that we face every day.
Yep.
In life, whether it's bad traffic or anything else,
mm-hmm.
we have to mitigate. Whether the problem lasts for 5 minutes or 5 days or whatever, it still has to be mitigated. And the way to mitigate it is to know as much about it as you can. Mm-hmm. And it's critical. Know your friends, but keep your friends close, but keep your enemies closer.
Right.
Is what we're talking about. The more you know about what drives your enemy, what that enemy's tendencies, what their habits, what their methods are, then the better an opportunity you have of neutralizing them, to put it in today's terms.
Right.
Or to solve the problem they present.
Right.
And keep in mind, as you mentioned, it's not just people who are enemies or another country or another way of thinking. It could be the problems that we face every day. Alcoholism, poverty, ignorance, intolerance, I mean, you name it,
mm-hmm.
they're there. The more we know about what those are, especially racism, now, the better opportunity, the better chance we have of arriving at a solution for all of those, a healthy solution for everybody. The one example in history for us as Lakota people and for Native people and indigenous people in general is that we learned to get along with the environment. We learned what in the environment was dangerous and what was not. And we learned about each other as other indigenous groups, who were our enemies, who were our friends, who could we trade with, who could we not, who had the kind of tendencies that we liked and who didn't. So we knew all the other people around us as well as we possibly could. And so that mitigated a lot of, I'm sure that prevented a lot of wars.
Right.
A lot of conflict, a lot of confrontation. The one segment that we didn't know much about were white people.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't come to know them as well as we did other indigenous groups. And we either underestimated or overestimated them. And sometimes both. But the bottom line was we didn't know about them.
Right.
We didn't know about their tendencies. We didn't know about the whole aim to conquer a whole,
right.
whole continent. And we didn't think of interaction with them as in terms of an entire campaign. We were focused on one event and didn't look beyond that. And we didn't know that we didn't know the history of Europe. We didn't know the history of what they did in Europe and came here. So we were in the dark a lot. So that was one of the reasons that history has turned out the way it has.
So we talked a little bit about the white settlers coming through and the sheer numbers that had to be understood by those that were here had to be unimaginable.
Well, we at first we didn't.
Mm-hmm.
That was, again, part of the problem. I think the people who got that, sort of got an inkling of that, were the leaders who went to Washington to treat with, American officials. And they saw the size of the cities.
Mm-hmm.
They rode on the railroads. They saw the number of people along the way, the number of people who lived in the cities, the size of the buildings. And they were, not only were they awed, but they were terrified
mm-hmm.
by the number of white people. Keep in mind that the largest population on the plains was probably the Lakota
mm-hmm.
and the Dakota and Nakota, about 25,000. They say the Blackfeet was about the same. So the average size of a typical tribe, if you will, was just a few thousand, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, mm-hmm. 9,000. So in terms of population, individual tribes were not that big.
No.
When we look back on history in the mid-1800s, Again, there were, you know, about 20 to 25,000 Lakota. At the same time, the combined tribes of the plains from central Texas all the way into central Canada was probably about 300,000. No one knows for sure. That's a lot of people, 300,000. However, at the same time, the white population in America was 25 million.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a slight imbalance, and there was too much because, you know, even if we could kill everybody that came along, even if we could chase them all off, there was always still more coming.
Right.
And it wasn't just the number of people. It was the number of guns,
mm-hmm.
and number of weapons. The combined attitude that they brought together as such a large group of people, that attitude of exclusivity, that manifest destiny, if you will,
mm-hmm.
white supremacy, all those things were too much for us to mitigate as individual tribes.
Right.
And we never, ever formed any kind of alliance to meet that, the threat of sheer numbers. And so also they brought guns, they brought alcohol, and all the technology that came with it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what really overwhelmed us, was just plain numbers.
Absolutely. So we're talking about knowing your enemy, and we talked about knowing who your enemies are as people, who your enemies are as issues in the world, both pre-reservation and now. And what about sometimes the toughest enemy of all, which is the one that's within us?
Right. I mean, I think if there's anything that we learned from our own history is that we should have known a lot of things that were happening better than we did.
Mm-hmm.
If there's anything that we were guilty of, it's because we didn't think of the confrontation or the interaction with white folks as an overarching event. We just looked at each incident as in and of itself. The Dakota had the uprising in 1862, and we had our own issues over here west across the river. We didn't think of them as related. We didn't realize that the same attitude that was driving the white folks from forcing them to stamp out the 1862 rebellion, the same attitude that they brought to us in Lakota country.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't consider that. So in that sense, we were very naive, that we didn't think of this as a big picture. We thought each of those as individual events. I mean, that's how we, you know, people think that we were a warlike nation. We were really not at all. I mean, a man grew up to be a hunter and a warrior and spent most of his time as the provider, the hunter. Probably 65 to 75% of his time was spent as the hunter, procuring the materials that one needed for food, shelter, and clothing. Mm-hmm. So that left 30% of the time to be the warrior.
Mm-hmm.
And, but there were times when it was necessary to be that warrior.
Mm-hmm.
So we were not warlike in that sense. We were not imperialistic. We didn't go out and conquer land for the sake of conquering land.
Mm-hmm.
We would move into a territory and occupy it just to use the resources. And if there was other people there, either we made friends with them, we became allies with them, or we confronted them and they moved away, or we didn't move into the territory. It was that simple. There were no long, drawn-out wars over land itself among individual indigenous tribes, which is what Europeans assume we did because they did that. We were not imperialistic. Again, that was part of our character. Maybe one can look at that as our shortcoming, if you will, in comparison to how Europeans approach manifest destiny. So we didn't look at those issues because we didn't have a tendency in ourselves. So in that sense, we were our own worst enemy.
Right. So let's talk about the fourth. We've covered know yourself, covered know your friends, know your enemies. And then we take it into the fourth step, which is that leaders need to then take action. They need to take the lead or do this by example. Yeah,
exactly.
And it, your passion for education is very important, I think, with this. You say the first three factors rise from intellect, but the last factor is from the chante, right?
From the heart.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So tell us how somebody might accomplish that taking what you have and then acting on
it. It's the simplest and also the hardest of the four. Take the lead. It's easy to say it. Go first. Go first. In other words, a leader in our pre-reservation society didn't stand back and say, okay, you go do this and you go do that, and I'll stand here and wait. You did it first.
Mm-hmm.
You showed them how it was done. You not only talked the talk, you walked the walk, as it were, to put it in today's vernacular. And there's nothing more powerful than a volunteer or an example. If you do something a certain way and say, yeah, this is how it's done, people will do it because you've shown them the way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the final edicts of leadership is have courage and be the first to charge the enemy. It's simple enough to say, really hard to do. I mean, we take that in context of, say, meeting somebody on a battlefield, but it's still just as applicable in everyday life. Sometimes it's hard to do the right thing. Sometimes you doubt if I do this, will it make a difference?
Mm-hmm.
But as a teacher, as a parent, as anyone who has an influence over anybody else, you take the first step and you do it. You're showing people this is the way to do it. This is the right thing to do. That's the most powerful example you can give, especially to children. Because they're watching, whether you think they're watching or not.
Right.
They are watching us all as adults.
Right.
No matter who we are, whether we're a teacher or just a parent or anything else, they watch.
A couple other touch points that I wonder if you would touch on are Spotted Tail's undaunted courage when it comes to taking the lead in things.
Spotted Tail is one of those men who was both a civilian and a military leader.
Mm-hmm.
Early on in his life, he established his reputation as a military leader. He was one of the people, I think, who was at the Blue Water incident in Nebraska, along with Iron Shell and Little Thunder and so forth. And he demonstrated his courage, physical courage, on the battlefield then. After that, came issues that he stood up for that didn't require him to be a warrior, but a good leader and a man of character. And he didn't shirk that responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
He did what he thought was right. He allowed his children to be sent to Carlisle, but then after he found out exactly what was going on there, he brought them back because he saw it as a bad place. So he did those kinds of things that sort of set him apart and showed the rest of the people that he, you know, he understood what was going on. And that's one of the requirements of a leader, is for a leader to comprehend a situation and look at the big picture and try to mitigate it as much as possible. And I think if there's one characteristic that one could say about Spotted Tail, that was it.
Okay. The undaunted courage take that step. The Council of Old Men, do you have anything to say about that as it relates to leadership?
It's exactly what we need today.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about tribal councils. I'm talking about a group of people who have life experiences, who are, for example, in a village, in a community. Let's say there are 30 older guys, and the youngest of them is 60 years old. And obviously others are older, so however old they are, they bring all that life experience to the lodge every time they sit down together.
Mm-hmm.
So you have hundreds of years of life experience. You have hundreds of years of knowledge together in one place. So when there is a problem, when there's a situation to be discussed, everybody has input. Everybody has an opinion about how to mitigate a situation, solve a problem, develop a philosophy, whatever is required. And that's what they apply.
Mm-hmm.
That council of old men. It isn't just because they're old. They have wisdom born mm-hmm. of hard-won experience. And that's what we're lacking now.
Mm-hmm.
We have tribal councils that have young people that stand for election because they meet a minimum age requirement. That doesn't mean necessarily they have the wisdom and the experience mm-hmm. to and the insight to be a good leader. Some of them, unfortunately, don't. So that council of old men is exactly what we need now.
Right. And isn't a tribal council almost kind of a product or a reflection of the government that was brought into this country, a European
exactly.
model of government?
Right. They gave us that form of government pattern after their own.
Yeah. And the last note that I have is the wear the shirt. Does that resonate with you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there was a status within the Lakota culture, pre-reservation again. The last time that we know of where this particular ceremony took place was in 1865, probably. And one of the last people to be part of that was Crazy Horse and He Dog, his friend. And wearing a shirt simply means, that's what it is, a shirt. A shirt made out of four different bighorn sheep hides, one for the front, one for the back, and one for each arm. And it was elaborately decorated with quill work
mm-hmm.
or beads, because beads were in abundance then, and with strips of hair provided by the female members of that family. They were the ones who made the shirt. And the shirt was made to sort of characterize what the man was, certainly what colors he represented. Crazy Horse was a thunder dreamer, so his colors were blue and yellow.
Mm-hmm.
Blue for thunder, yellow for lightning. So that was prominent on his shirt. And the ceremony were very simple. Once these young men were selected and they were eventually known as shirt wearers, but they were young men of good character
mm-hmm.
who had the potential to be leaders, who had already demonstrated in their young lives, they were in their 20s probably, that they had all the requisite characters, or most of them, to be good leaders and good people. That's the reason they were selected. And the status they were given didn't have any authority, didn't have any power. It was just simply a social status. And the only requirement was to live a life beyond reproach as an example to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And the elders were the one who asked them. We're asking you to do this. And what if you accept, then you wear the shirt as a symbol of your office. So there was an elaborate ceremony. It was a feast, and the villages would gather, and old people would get up and talk to these young men. And one of the first things they would say is what I said earlier: before you think of yourself, you think of others. That's the hallmark of a leader.
Mm-hmm.
That's the very first thing that they were told: think of others before you think of yourself. And essentially their version of walk the walk, and not talk the talk.
Right.
Be the kind of person where people will, you go out and do something so that people will pay attention to what you do, and then they'll pay attention to what you say.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing was have courage and be the first to charge the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So you can imagine as a young man, and not every young man who was asked to take this shirt, except Crazy Horse turned it down.
That's, I was going to ask you right. about that, because I thought you said that one time.
Yeah, he turned it down, but his father talked him into accepting it
mm-hmm.
because he, you know, other elders came to him and said, we need your son to do this. But initially he turned it down. He didn't want the responsibility. Mm-hmm. But imagine being the focal point of all of this, sitting and listening to that. This is what mm-hmm. we expect of you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what wearing a shirt means.
Right, right. I think I want to wrap this up by asking more for the parents that we work with. If they were to raise a child to be a leader, what's one thing that they could do, maybe starting even on today? You know, what's something they could do?
Be careful what they do and say.
Mm-hmm.
Do the kind of things that will influence. I mean, everything we do influences kids.
Right.
So we need to be very careful about what we do, how we do it, what we say, because we're the role models, whether we like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
Young people are watching us.
Right.
And especially as parents and as grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
If we had a tendency to fly off the handle, get angry, meet everything with anger, then that's what we're teaching.
Mm-hmm.
If we meet a situation with patience and tolerance and we listen, that's what we're teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So it's whatever we do, they're learning.
Mm-hmm. I like that, and I think it's a good place to wrap up. And I think that as a Lala, as a grandfather, your grandkids are watching your path and what you do in a good way. I humbly say that, and I would say that the other piece is that your ancestors, you were a Tekoja once as well.
Exactly.
And you had grandparents that taught you and modeled for you in a good way. And those ancestors of yours are looking down and watching your Chunkuluta and watching the way you walk in a good way. So I humbly say that. And as always, Joseph, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
And Ho-Choka. Thanks for being here. Thank you for joining us here in Ho-Choka at the center of St. Joseph's Indian Schools campus, where we talk about issues that are central to Native American education today. Until next time, stay centered.